That is very dynamic music. I got to be honest, I don't think I can live up to the dynamics of that music.
Yes, you can.
You're kind of saying that, Dave. Hi, everybody. It's me, Bill. Half of the team of Bill and Wendy. The other half, Wendy, on vacation, and she will return on Monday. But in the meantime, we spin the wheel of co-hosts, and it lands on Mike Toomey today. Mike Toomey from the WGN-TV Morning News. One of my best friends in the world will be joining us in just a little while. He's finishing up his duties at WGN-TV, and he's en route, and he'll be here then. In the meantime, another of my best friends, Dave Ennett, is in studio with me to talk a little bit about some of the peculiarities of last night's All-Star game. First of all, Dave, thanks for being here. Second of all, it was a pretty good game last night.
It was a pretty good game.
Wasn't it?
I thought it was entertaining as an All-Star game goes. A lot of home runs. If you like home runs, you had to like it.
A total of 10.
A total of 10. And so I looked this morning to see when the last time, I'd seen the number that the previous record was 6 for an All-Star game. And the last time that happened was 1971. So I looked to see who the 6 were who hit the home runs in that game.
Were they noted home run hitters?
Hank Aaron?
I guess you'd put him in that category, yeah.
Reggie Jackson?
Yeah, kind of.
Roberto Clemente?
Yeah, sort of.
Harmon Killebrew? Wow. Frank Robinson? There's one more. But there were 6.
Wow.
6 guys, all of whom are in the Hall of Fame. Last night, there were 10 home runs hit by 10 different players. I would say maybe one of them is going to be in the Hall of Fame, Mike Trout.
Yeah, Mike Trout for sure. Yeah.
The others, I'm not so sure.
So this goes back to something I had a discussion with a friend 2 years ago, whereas when we were kids, it seemed like the All-Stars were perennial All-Stars. They were the true greats of baseball. And now, like, even I watched the game last night. I'm not kidding when I tell you there were 10 guys playing that I go, I'm not sure who he is or where did he come from.
Yeah.
So why is that?
Is that baseball or is that you, Bill, do you think?
You know what I think it is? I think because when we were growing up, there were less teams. There were 24 teams as opposed to today's 30. So
for some of us, there were even fewer teams than that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So does that play into it a little bit?
I think it probably does. Yeah. I think, plus, you know, here's the other thing, too. I think the fact that guys stayed with one team for an extended period of time in the pre-free agency era, I think that you really got to know every player and what team he played for.
Yep.
And today with guys moving around from team to team on a more regular basis, I think, and more guys because there's more teams, I think that all probably does lead to that idea that, well, it's not like the old days when you knew every guy on the All-Star team.
One of the Cubs announcers a couple of weeks ago talked about how the shelf life of a baseball player is shorter now for a couple reasons. Reason number one, teams want to bring in new blood, right? Mm-hmm. Like they were talking about Ben Zobrist, how he's the old veteran on the Cubs, and they said in the older days of baseball, every team had one or two or sometimes three guys that were like Ben Zobrist that had been around the game for a long time and could help with the younger players, and that's kind of gone away a little bit. So that's part of it, right?
Apparently not in St. Louis, where they like to help their younger players giving them a rough time in the clubhouse.
Yes.
I think that's probably true to a certain extent. Yeah. I think teams generally, and here's the other part of that too. Guys have made more money over the course of their career.
That's the other thing.
So they don't
need
have
to hang
to
around
play as long. If they feel their skills are diminished, they don't have to keep trying to hang on.
Right. So
some
true.
Do because they hate to give it up. And they love the life and they love to play.
Yep.
And they like the paycheck.
Yep. So two of our three Chicago position players got hits, and that's always nice to see one of the Chicago players get hit. John Lester, who had made the team, didn't pitch at all because he had just pitched on Sunday, so you want to rest him, and that makes sense, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Now, the reason I asked you to stay is this. Some side controversy went on during the game last night.
Bryce Harper didn't cheat to win the home run derby.
Did he cheat last night during the All-Star game?
Yeah, he did.
He did. He definitely cheated last night.
Yes.
All right, so I want to say nice things about him because I hold in my head the hope that he will be a Cub next year. There's been a lot of talk of that. So even though I don't want to like Bryce Harper, I go, yeah, but if he becomes a Cub, I want to welcome him to the city. So let's see how it plays out. All right, so here's the sidebar of last night's game. And I know you guys talked about this a little bit on the morning show, but it's a pretty important story. The Milwaukee Brewers have a young relief pitcher named Josh Hader, who's having an amazing season. He's a really hard pitcher to hit. Last night, he didn't fare so well on the field or off.
No.
All right, so the sidebar story about Josh Hader is this. When he was younger, he's now in his mid-20s. When he was a teenager, he put some things online, on social media, that are extremely negative toward gay people, toward black people, toward women. You pick the group. Josh Hader said he lived up to his name. He said some horrible things about people. All this information was released, strangely enough, during last night's All-Star game. Nobody kind of knew about this, and then all of a sudden it was all over the place that Josh Hader has a history of putting things on social media that are not pleasant. He put the phrase, "I hate gay people," at some point. He put KKK. He put white power. Said that women should only be used for cooking, cleaning, and sex. All negative things. Now, here's the question that I ask you, Dave. He was a kid when he said these things. He was in his teens. He's an adult now. He's a Major League Baseball player. What happens next? Does he get disciplined from the team, from the Milwaukee Brewers? Does he get disciplined from the league, from Major League Baseball? Should he be disciplined? He did a press conference yesterday. He was part of a press conference where he said, "I don't feel that way. I did feel that way when I was a kid. I don't feel that way now." What happens with Josh Hader now?
Well, I think that Major League Baseball is going to take a long look at this, because if they don't react at all to something that was obviously there, people are aware of, then they're accused of turning a blind eye to it and just ignoring the problem. Now, when it's something which has occurred in real time with the active player tweeting or saying something offensive, they have acted. Kevin Pillar, Toronto, got suspended a couple of games for using a gay slur against another player. And so it'll be interesting to see how they handle this. This is something that this guy said or posted on Twitter 7 years ago. It all came back to haunt him last night during the All-Star game, which should have been one of the great moments of his young career.
Right.
He's pitching in the All-Star, in this great All-Star game, in a tight situation, gives up a home run. But so Major League Baseball said afterwards they would wait until today to say anything about this. In the meantime, Hader, when he got out of the game, when he went to the clubhouse afterwards, his phone had blown up, and he realizes that all this stuff has been going on unbeknownst to him.
He was oblivious to it until the game was over.
Apparently until after the game.
All right.
Which is when it all, someone found the stuff on his Twitter. However, they went back and searched and found it, and there it was. You know, this it lives forever, right,
on social media. You know the part about his family being at the game.
His family was at the game. They were wearing his replica jersey, and so his family was given neutral gear to put on.
They're whisked away to the bowels of the stadium there in Washington and given clothes that don't have Hader's name all over it and his number all over it, just so that they can sit and enjoy the game without people taunting them.
Or just get out of there safely.
Yeah, right, right.
So here's what happens. He goes to the clubhouse, realizes what's happened, gets asked about it, apologizes, says, "That's not me. That was me when I was a dumb kid 7 years ago.
Yeah,
maybe I thought that then. Some of it was quotes from some rap lyrics."
That's the part where I kind of get lost. I mean, I'm sure he could easily be influenced by quotes from rap lyrics, but at 17, I like to think you're responsible enough to know not to put it on social media.
You certainly hope so. And I don't know about you. I drilled it in to my kids. Don't put anything on social media.
It's forever.
This, going back to junior high.
Right.
I mean, when this stuff all started to happen, I said, anything you put on there is going to, it's going to outlive you.
Yes.
You know, and you just have to be really careful. And this is something he said. Look, I take full responsibility. Whatever consequences there are, I accept them. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But baseball can't go back in people's lives and punish them for things they did before they ever were associated, right?
But, Steve, I mean, don't you think that's what's being determined today?
Well, I know, but, I mean, if there was a cost to him for this, baseball should have scrubbed his Twitter account and come to terms with it before they signed a contract.
Well, I think in terms of a punishment, I guess it all depends on what the reaction is, the public reaction to it. And also, does Major League Baseball issue a public reprimand,
right,
but not discipline him?
Right, something like that. Because how can you suspend someone for something they did before they were ever associated with you?
That, see, I guess that's what separates this. If he puts this on his Twitter feed a week ago, then you got a problem. Mm-hmm. But you could easily say this was a guy who just, he wasn't fully formed yet. He was 16 or 17 years old. He wasn't thinking clearly. He didn't really have much world knowledge at the time. You can make all that defense for him. So, and I imagine they will, but it's going to be hard to judge the public reaction to this in a day or two. Major League Baseball said they're going to make a statement today as to what they're going to do about this. But can they really tell in a day? I don't know if they can.
I don't know if they can or not. And it may be what kind of reaction there is.
Yeah.
And if it becomes a big enough deal, like I said this morning, this isn't John Rocker, mm-hmm, who made his comments in an interview,
magazine interview,
while he was a player, and he had just done it, and he was and the subject of all this reaction. This is something you're going back in time.
Right, 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 right.
If you remember Greg Olson, when he was drafted by the Bears.
Steve and I had this discussion today. A video surfaced,
he
right?
had done a rap video, and he was at the University of Miami, which had, I don't remember specifically what was in it, but it had some very offensive language. And, of course, as soon as the Bears drafted him, here comes this video
right.
resurfacing.
I remember it was very derogatory toward women. I don't remember the specifics, but it did not paint Greg Olson in a very good light, I remember.
No, but
all right, let's do this. Let's take a quick break, and we'll discuss this further. What are your thoughts? What do you do with a guy like this, a baseball player? He's in his mid-20s now, but as a teenager, he said some horrible, horrible things. Do you just forget about it, or do you discipline him? What do you think? 312-981-7200. Back after this, it's Bill Leff on WGN. Still left with you on WGN. Wendy Snyder, my partner, gone for the rest of this week. She's on vacation. She will return on Monday. Dave Ennett, kind enough to stick around from the Steve Cochran Show. We're talking about this pitcher.
Josh Hader.
Josh Hader pitches for the Milwaukee Brewers, a middle reliever. He's in his mid-20s. Apparently, when he was a teenager, he put a whole bunch of things on social media that are extremely negative toward black people, toward gay people, toward women. Uses KKK, says that he hates gay people, says that women are only good for cleaning and for cooking and for sex. He was a kid at the time. So many of the texts, Dave, actually I'm trying to find one that doesn't say a version of this, but so many of them say, as a 17-year-old, he cannot or should not be held responsible, that a 17-year-old can't possibly understand the magnitude of putting something online when they're a kid. That is mentioned over and over and over in the texts. What do you think of this?
Well, I guess the question is, are you the same as you were when you were 17? Now, granted, you're not 24,
mm-hmm,
but I mean, I look back at myself. I think you do grow a lot from high school into your post-college life,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I mean, people grow up. People do dumb things when they're teen. I mean, how many times do people do dumb, not necessarily what they post on social media, but just you act like a knucklehead
right.
at a young age.
Right.
And I'm not in any way trying to diminish the seriousness of what he said.
Yeah.
But I do think that at some point people get a second chance. And it seems if it's ever appropriate to do that, it would be when you do something when you're a teenager.
But wouldn't that almost say to kids who are teenagers, you're going to experience a free pass?
Yeah.
And that scares me. And no, I'm not the same person I was at 17 or 24 or even a year ago.
Right.
But even at 17, I was savvy enough to go, I could potentially do or say something now as a 17-year-old that could haunt me for the rest of my life.
And I think I was too.
Yeah.
But
I know everyone's not like that.
Not everybody, but I also
You didn't have Twitter at the time, though. I mean,
that's true.
I was very conscious not to write letters that would be looked at 50 years from now, but no one was looking at letters that we wrote.
Yeah,
you know, this stuff is available to anyone, and you know, teenagers are stupid. That's when you go through your stupid times.
I know. All right, there's a whole bunch of calls. We'll get to one or two of them, I promise. Let's start out with Mary. Hey, Mary, you're on WGN. What do you think of all this?
Well, I think there's a total lack of common sense in dealing with some of these. There's quick judgments of the society. It's hypocritical. A young person wrote years ago, he apologized. There's only certain topics that get this far in the general response. And I think that's hypocritical as well. No, I'm forgiving him. Let him go. He apologized. We're all different now than we were when teenagers. It bothers me very, very much.
Yeah.
That we spent so much time on something like this.
But do you think, I don't know if you saw the press conference yesterday or clips of it since, do you think he apologized because he realized this has the potential to really make him not only look bad, but he could be suspended or cut from the team because of this? Or did he apologize because he genuinely really looks back at that and says, wow, did I make a mistake?
Both. You're making
both?
The judgment on what he was doing then,
yeah.
And how he was thinking then. And then you're judging, well, is he sincere enough? Yeah, he is. He's sincere enough.
You know,
we judge people so harshly, it's like we're all God. And God doesn't even judge that harshly.
I think the other thing we're not privy to is how he acts today. I mean, maybe you see him on the field, or maybe people see him occasionally interacting with fans and his teammates know how he is.
Have you read any of their comments? Because they've been very interesting in his support. They have said that he is a very good guy, a very even keeled guy, and that means something.
Yeah, Lorenzo Cain, who is an African American, who has come out and pretty much come out in support of him.
Yeah.
So I think you have to put some stock in that.
Yeah.
Mary, absolutely.
Thank you for the call.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it. Have a good week. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
What do you imagine will happen?
I think the Major League Baseball or the Brewers or somebody will issue a statement condemning the past tweets and the past social media stuff. And I don't see baseball punishing him.
No suspension, no fine.
But I could see some sort of a public reprimand.
Yeah.
And don't ever let it happen again.
Right. That'll make sense.
Yeah.
Dave, thanks for sticking around.
You bet.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's Bill Left with you. Wendy Snyder on vacation until Monday. My guest live in studio, Dr. Terry Mason. Dr. Mason is the chief operating officer of Cook County's Department of Public Health, and there's so much to discuss health-wise. Thank you very much for being here, Dr. Mason. Greatly appreciate it. Hold on. Hold on. Say that again.
Grateful to be here.
There you go. All right. If you wouldn't mind, I know this is a strange thing to start out with, but I think this certainly bears some mention. They talked over to the people at Google about what health problem, state by state, is Googled the most, and I'm very surprised to hear what it is in Illinois. Tell everybody, what is the number one health issue that is Googled in Illinois?
Syphilis.
Syphilis. And why would that be?
I'm not sure why that's what people think about. But, you know, here's the other part, is that there are many other diseases, and people may not know what they are.
Yeah.
And they may think, because many of us just don't know.
Yeah.
And we may think we have something that we don't.
Yeah.
And syphilis in Chicago has been very popularized because it was something that people like Al Capone had. And
right.
Some people know about
it. It took the life of Al Capone, right?
It took the life of Al Capone. And there were some great Roman folks that also had syphilis and things of that nature. Because syphilis is a disease that does create lifelong problems, both for the person who has it, who doesn't get it treated, and for an unborn the unborn child whose mom may attract this before she delivers the baby. So, it creates a lot of difficult, very difficult problems.
Sure.
Including death.
Yeah.
And it can infect your brain and things of that nature. So, it's a pretty important disease. I would say if you'd done this a few years ago, probably HIV or AIDS would have been the most Googled topic.
Well, I don't know how old you are, and it's none of my business, but when I was growing
up... I don't mind. I'm 67.
Are you 67? You're doing something right. I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it. All right, so when I was a kid, the thing that anybody who was engaging in any sexual activity was worried about were diseases like syphilis, mm-hmm. and then the AIDS epidemic came through, and syphilis took not just a backseat, but a way, way, way backseat, but then it kind of reemerged, didn't it?
Yeah, syphilis did reemerge, and people get, you know, these days you can get twofers, or even a threefer.
Yeah.
So if you're having, particularly if you're having unprotected sex with different partners, you could get a dose of syphilis and a dose of gonorrhea and a dose of chlamydia all within a night.
That would be a bad night. I would call that, I would refer to that night as a horrible, horrible night. Is the prevention of syphilis just as simple as wearing a condom, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, no. I mean, the prevention of most sexually transmitted infections is as simple as wearing a condom that you're wearing correctly.
Yeah.
And for the woman, now it's a little more difficult. There are female condoms.
Yeah.
But obviously, you should insist that your partner wears protection, assuming these are heterosexual encounters.
Yeah. Whoever's getting syphilis now, if you had to do a breakdown in category-wise, are you looking mostly at teenagers, early 20s?
Well, we look at people 15 to 24, and it's actually higher in the what we call the men who have sex with men group.
Yeah,
here in the city of Chicago. But let me just give you perspective.
Sure.
Do you know that if you're having unprotected I'll get this right.
Unprotected
if
sex.
If you're having unprotected sex
yes.
with someone.
My wife will kill me.
You're 55 times more likely to get gonorrhea.
55 times more likely.
50 times more likely to get chlamydia than syphilis.
Oh, that's a staggering number,
and
isn't it?
13 times more likely to get gonorrhea
wow.
than syphilis.
Wow.
So even though people talk about it, it's certainly not the most common sexually transmitted infection we have. By far and away, chlamydia rates, and actually, unfortunately, the Cook County has the highest number of cases of gonorrhea and chlamydia in the United States.
Because we have
a lot of people who are having unprotected sex, and they're spreading it, and we're talking about younger and younger and younger people.
All right, so when you hear that, your job title, Chief Operating Officer of Cook County's Department of Public Health, when you hear that, do you say to yourself, well, we have to do something to stem the tide. We have to do something to reverse this. What are we not doing here in Cook County that's leading to numbers that are that huge?
Well, first of all, we need much more prevention messaging.
Yeah.
And then secondly, we need to make it extraordinarily easy for people who may think they have been exposed. Because here's the thing. Most of these diseases produce absolutely no symptoms early on. So we always think of gonorrhea with having a discharge, or even chlamydia with having a discharge, or syphilis with having a sore on the penis.
Yes.
But the sore on the penis for syphilis can come and go, but it doesn't mean the disease went away. The discharge for a chlamydia and gonorrhea can come and go, and you still have not gotten rid of the disease.
Yeah.
So you need, the only way is not to guess, but get a test.
Right.
And nowadays, it used to be in the old days to get a test for gonorrhea or chlamydia, you had to insert a little swab. But nowadays, the technology is much better. All you have to do is urinate in a cup, and you can get a test for both gonorrhea and chlamydia just from a urine sample.
And are the results instantaneous, or does it take a little while?
Well, you have to send it to a lab. But these test for syphilis still requires a blood test.
It does. Yeah.
And we have to know that if you had sex tonight and you had unprotected sex, it does not mean that you could have gotten something that night that will show up in a test tomorrow.
Right.
So some of these things have what we call an incubation, or a period of time between the time you become exposed to it and the time the test takes to get positive.
Mm-hmm.
So I want people not to be misled that if they have a test, if they had sex on Friday and they decide, I'm going to go to the doctor and get a test on 2 days later, and the test is negative, that they're negative. No, they're negative at that point in time. But it may take more time before the test actually becomes positive. And secondly, it does not mean that you don't have anything because you didn't get a discharge with respect to chlamydia and gonorrhea.
If I may state the obvious, if you do suspect that you have something like this, you may want to refrain from any sexual activity until you know for sure. Is that
absolutely
correct?
Because you don't want to spread that to anyone else.
Right.
But that does happen. Right. And because people are having sex all kinds of ways these days, when we do an examination, we have to look for all the areas where persons could have been penetrated or had a sexual organ placed for evidence that there is a problem.
Yeah.
So, for example, we have a lot of people who end up with gonorrhea of the throat.
Yeah.
And so you have to swab the throat just like you do when you're looking for a strep throat for the tonsils.
Right.
Or you have to swab any of the other body cavities or spaces or parts where the sex actually took place. And for syphilis, you obviously have to wait and get a blood test. And the blood test doesn't turn positive. If you had sex on Monday, the test doesn't turn positive on Tuesday. It may take a week or two before
there's an incubation period.
Yes, yeah. There is an incubation period. And the same thing is true for gonorrhea and chlamydia. Those, though much faster, will usually produce some symptoms, but not always. And these things are not without long-term consequences.
All right, getting to that really quickly. Let's say you find out, you go in and you test it, and then you find out the tests are positive that you do have it. What takes place after that?
If you are positive, the great news is that you can get one medication that'll take care of both your chlamydia and your gonorrhea. So that's
good news.
That's good news. That's the good news. The bad news is that we've got a lot of gonorrhea that's resistant out there. So we have to make sure that people are getting the right medication, and then they follow up.
Yes.
To get another culture or a test after they've completed the medication.
To see if it's been eradicated.
To be sure that it's been eradicated and you don't have one of those resistant strains. Syphilis is a shot. Okay.
A one-time thing?
It's usually a one-time thing.
Yeah.
You get a shot. Now, that doesn't make you syphilis proof.
Yeah.
That just takes care of that particular infection at that time.
Yeah.
And syphilis, as you know, goes through different stages. There's a primary stage where people may get a rash.
Yes.
They may get a sore on the penis or on the inside of the vagina or wherever that the sex took place.
Yeah.
And that takes a while for that to come. And there are no symptoms. There are no symptoms. And of course, we have to be concerned because if a woman is pregnant, she could pass this on to our unborn child.
Right.
Both the syphilis, the gonorrhea, all these things can be passed on.
That voice you hear is that of Dr. Terry Mason, the Chief Operating Officer of Cook County's Department of Public Health. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about what you say, Dr. Mason, is causing a lot more disease than ever before, a major factor. It's something that relates to all of us. We'll get into that in just a little bit. It's Bill F. on WGN. Wendy's off this week. She'll be back on Monday. My guest is Dr. Terry Mason, Chief Operating Officer of Cook County's Department of Public Health. The first segment, we talked about sexually transmitted diseases, but now this is a great topic.
Sure.
There's something causing an illness or a series of illnesses, of diseases, and I like your theory. I agree with you. What is it?
Well, if we ask, what is the number one cause of death in America, people would say heart disease.
Right.
And I would ask, is it? And the reason I ask that is because what are you really talking about? You're talking about a blockage in the blood vessel that goes to the heart, stops the blood, and the heart muscle dies.
Yeah.
The question is, how did that blockage happen? Where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it came from something that was in the blood that interacted with the wall of the artery that irritated it and made it scab up and cause that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where did that come from? That came from the food we're eating.
Yep. Yep.
So it's the food, if we want to look at the most important cause, the most important person in this chain or important component in this chain, it's food. And the food is what we're eating. Much of these processed stuff that the body is, in a very oversimplistic way, I would say, is saying, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
And so it reacts. It creates what we call inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
Inflammation is just irritation. That irritation, the body's like, okay, I've got to try and fix this. So it tries to heal over it.
Yeah.
But what happens is, what do? We just keep insulting it. Every 3 times a day, we're sending another batch of this inflammatory stuff into our blood vessels, and we never give our bodies an opportunity to heal. So we do things, and people have chest pain, and we tell people that those are early signs, but they're not. Chest pain is not early. That's late.
Yeah.
It's like waiting until you get slurred speech and what have you, and you're having a stroke. You're not going to have a stroke. You're having a stroke.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the issue and the things that we do very quickly, where we put little, and these are life-saving things, we put little catheters in and we put balloons in and we just get to the area that's blocked, and then we blow up the balloon and smash the inflammatory plaque against the wall and then put a little stent in to hold it open. But we've done nothing to deal with the proximate cause of the problem, which is the food.
Tell me what your thoughts are on this. Our country, the United States, sure, accepts food that other parts of the country would just reject as dangerous. But here in the U.S., we revel in those foods. How do we change this?
Well, first of all, I think that what we have to do is we need to go back to foods in a more natural state.
Yeah.
And we need to eat foods that come out of the ground more than we eat foods that fly over the ground,
yeah,
walk on the ground, slither on it, swim in it,
yeah,
those kinds of things. That's what we need to do. Secondly, we have a major problem with our production. So, for example, one of the things I was going to talk about with regard to chlamydia and gonorrhea, we talked about resistance.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the issue is, how are the antibiotics becoming resistant? Well, what we're doing now is we're feeding our animals, our chicken, our cows. We're feeding them feed that contains antibiotics and the antibiotics to help prevent them from getting infections. But these antibiotics are mutating because the bugs they're fighting are now getting smarter.
Mm-hmm.
And we eat the meat from these things, and then we get these bacteria that are now resistant to what we would normally get. And we're at the point right now in America where we're down to maybe one or two antibiotics if the ones that we have don't work. And this is a very serious problem of antibiotic resistance in America.
Yeah.
But the biggest source of it is coming from our food.
Have you seen this commercial where they take on McDonald's and they show chickens, and they say that McDonald's is giving chickens various growth hormones and things that are making it dangerous? They're making them grow too fast, too soon, and the result is not good for us. Have you seen any of these commercials? They're very scary.
Yeah, well, what we've done is our commercializing of the food system.
Yeah.
In order to get it, to make it more quote unquote productive,
yeah,
and to do it more efficiently and faster, we're using agents that allow the time between the time it takes a chick to go from a fertilized egg to a chicken. We've shrunk that time by more than a third.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily without consequences. So the foods that we're eating are creating this inflammatory response in our body. That inflammatory response shows up as a cancer. It shows up as heart disease. It shows up as a stroke. It shows up as diabetes.
Yeah.
It shows up in various sundry ways. And we at the Department of Public Health are looking at how do we begin to educate our public in a way that makes sense, that gives people the information that they can use to make an informed decision about what they're eating. I'm not pushing one thing. I'm just pushing good food, clean water,
sure,
exercise. That's
right.
It.
Right. The and basics.
So, the basics.
Do you think there's a correlation? My wife and I have discussed this with friends of ours about how kids, mostly girls, are developing faster, and everybody goes, well, it's got to be the growth hormones. Is it the growth hormones?
It is the hormones that are in the food. We have children now, girls that are starting their periods as young as 10.
Yeah.
And this is because when we're giving these things, again, there are some studies that seem to show that these hormones that are being fed to increase the productivity of our meat supply,
yeah,
are creating problems when we ingest it.
Yeah. So for the average person hearing this who says, wow, I agree with you, what do I do today? What do they do today?
Well, what I would suggest is that there are alternatives that people can go to if they want to continue to eat these meats. There are places where people do not use these things. Many of them are religious organizations.
Yeah.
I would also support strongly that people consider eating far more stuff, as I said before, that comes out of the ground, vegetables of all sorts. I have just whatever you like, but vegetables and fruits,
yeah,
and drinking water, not stuff that contains water or made from water,
right,
but water. And we're fortunate to have very good water here in the city, mm-hmm, of Chicago. Many people take it and put it in bottles and sell it to us. So we have a wonderful opportunity to do a much better job. And, of course, don't leave out some exercise because we're not doing enough either.
Do me a favor. Spin back for just a second. You said many of these places that are serving the better foods are religious organizations. Why is that?
Well, because many times people have a consciousness about what they're growing,
yeah,
and how they're growing it. So, not to mention any particular ones, but there's some that happen to be over in Indiana, not that far from us.
Yeah,
who
the
have
Amish farms? Are you
Amish
referring
farms,
to them?
Yes, yeah. They have some very strict rules about how they grow their food, how they feed their animals,
yeah,
and things of that nature. So that's why I said many of them are religious organizations. Not all,
yeah,
but many of them are. And I think as the American public becomes smarter and more educated about what we're eating, what we should be eating, we should eat more stuff that comes out of the ground, less of the stuff that flies over it, skips over it, swims in it,
right,
those sort of things. And
right,
definitely not those things that eat garbage.
Yeah.
Bottom
yeah
feeders.
Yeah, I'm with you. So nice to meet you, Dr. Mason.
It's been my pleasure.
I'm going to put you on speed dial. I will need your services on a daily basis from here on in. Is that okay?
I am only too happy, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to be with you today on your show.
Grateful to have you. That's Dr. Terry Mason, Chief Operating Officer of Cook County's Department of Public Health. If people want to know more, it's cookcountypublichealth.org, correct?
Is the
that's
website
the way to do
yes
it? Thanks for
moment
being here.
You're so welcome, and thank your guests, your listeners.
Sure. Thanks so much, Steve. It's Bill Left with you. My partner, Wendy Snyder, out for the rest of this week. She's on vacation. She'll be back on Monday. The good news is one of our favorite guests is in studio with me, Dr. John Duffy, clinical psychologist, certified life coach, parenting and relationship expert, and he's written a book or two.
Written a book or two.
Wait a second, John. Hold on a second. There you are.
I'm waiting?
There
okay
you are.
Yes,
now,
written
now
a book or two. Correct. Yes.
Let's also talk about that podcast for just a little bit, because everyone I know is loving it, and I've heard it, and I think you do a good job. It's you and your wife, and the podcast is called?
It's called Better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Julie's idea, my wife's brainstorm. I had a podcast called Undo Anxiety, which seemed to make people anxious, and she said, can't we do better? And
thus was born.
She was correct.
She
yes
was absolutely right. All right, several things to discuss with you, but before we get to the real topics, I just want your opinion on this.
Yeah.
Last night, the All-Star Game took place. I talked about this with Dave Ennett it a little bit earlier, but I need your advice on this. Josh Hader is a pitcher, middle reliever for the Milwaukee Brewers. Turns out, we learned during the game that as a kid, as a teenager, 16 or 17 years old, he put some horrible things on social media where he said bad things about gay people, about black people, about women.
Yeah.
He now says, hey, I was a kid then, I'm an adult now, I don't necessarily believe, well, not just not necessarily, I don't believe those things anymore. I've
right
grown up. What are your thoughts about this?
I tend to believe him. I look at this whole incident as a grand cautionary tale, because some of the things that we say and we do and we believe as kids, or if it's just bravado,
mm-hmm,
and but it's awful.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be that could be a fleeting moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now this stuff sticks with you. So here's a guy who's at the pinnacle of his career, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this horrible thing comes out about him, right? You know, and that colors the whole thing. And the kids I work with, I will be using that later today to tell them, you see how this can happen,
right?
You know what I mean? So it's definitely a cautionary tale. To a degree, I feel for him. It's easy to say, to villainize him. What an awful person for ever having said or felt these things. But as kids, I think we try on all sorts of different things, some of them not particularly flattering.
Right.
And now we do this in a very public forum, and sometimes that is not healthy for us.
Will our kids believe us when we say to them, because we're a little bit older and hopefully a little bit wiser, when we say, the internet is forever. What you put on there, you might think will get buried, but if somebody wants to find it, they'll find it. How do we convey that to them in a way that they'll believe us?
The only way to do that, in my experience, the lecture never, ever works, ever. If you just tell them this is going to follow, it's like what we were told when we were kids about the permanent record thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, I do know what you mean.
Yeah, none of us really, we all
right
knew, like, yeah, there's probably not
permanent
a permanent record.
Yeah.
Now there's a permanent record.
Yeah, there is.
But in my experience, the only way to convey the message that there's a permanent record is to tell a story or two. And I usually tell horror stories, cautionary tales that I hear in my office that are real, where kids' reputations are ruined. They have to switch schools. And even in the second school, they're bullied for something awful they say or do or post on Snapchat or Instagram that follows them and creates their whole persona,
yeah,
regardless of who they really are.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's horrible.
It is.
You know, last week we were talking during the bonus hour about Prince Harry. Now, Prince Harry seems to be a fine, upstanding guy, a great representative of the monarchy of England.
Yes.
But there was a time, I'm sure you remember this, where at a Halloween party he dressed like a Nazi,
yeah.
which is not a good idea.
Right.
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 So that's the kind of thing that you go, what exactly was he thinking? He's got to know at some point that this is going to be disturbing to a lot of people.
Right.
But that's another example of something. Now in his case, he has not only outlived it, most people don't even remember that that ever happened.
Right. I think I've thought of other examples that are similar, but that's a great one. I think about Rob Lowe and his transgression.
The sex tape, right?
Yeah. And some guys can outlive this. Some people can outlive some of this stuff. But kids now, you know, you can dig up anything. People are willing to root through Twitter going back, you know, till, you know, 10 years,
yeah.
you know, as old as Twitter is, and find something.
Yep.
That is damning, you
right.
know? So kids have to be so cautious and careful because they don't know what their future holds. And it's hard when you're 15 to think, I might be, you know, trying to get into grad school, running for office, you
right.
know, 15, 20 years from now, and somebody's going to dig this thing up.
Right.
So unless we tell them a story or two that resonates with them,
yes.
They will not understand that what I do now has some permanence.
And it's not just kids, John. Let's be honest. There's adults who could potentially put something on Facebook or on some other form of social media, and a boss could come across it and just go, that's not somebody we want representing our company.
It's true. And I find that parents and aunts and uncles are reluctant to share their humiliating stories
yeah.
with kids. And I think the more we're willing to do that and say, this is what happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, so this is not, this isn't fiction. We're not just trying to scare you for no reason here.
Right.
This is real.
Right. All right. Let's get on to the real topics. Enough of my nonsense. you wanted to talk, and I love this, about introversion and extroversion and
yeah.
how it relates to kids. Go ahead.
Yeah. So we make these presumptions. Oftentimes we'll label our kids in a lot of ways, one way or another. He or she's not a math person. He or she's not an athlete. But often I get like, she's shy. She's an introvert, you know, so this is what she is. And there's a negative connotation typically in parenting to my kid is an introvert versus my kid is an extrovert. So we put this kind of this standard around it, right? We evaluate it
mm-hmm.
instead of this being kind of a neutral kind of like, oh, my child is a little more introverted than extroverted. This is a continuum they fall on. And there's a great book out called Quiet that's a couple years old.
Mm-hmm.
You may have heard of it. And it kind of describes that, you know, the introverts, the more introverted of us, come up with ideas. We fuel our batteries when we're alone,
mm-hmm.
and we come up with ideas, and we're thinkers. Those of us who are a little more extroverted, we fuel our batteries when we're with other people,
right.
And we're the ones who are going to pass those ideas along. And the idea that there's some symbiosis there, that
yeah.
that we work together, I love that idea, because then there's no evaluation or judgment that, you know, one is worse than the other. But
right.
we are real quick as parents to label our kids. And oftentimes, if a kid especially gets labeled an introvert, they feel like, I'm doing something wrong just because I feel a little bit shy or maybe a little bit socially anxious sometimes.
Why is that? I'm curious why that would be.
Why they feel negative about it.
Well, that a child who is more of an introvert than an extrovert would be labeled as, oh, just quiet and shy, likes to keep to themselves, that's a bad thing. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's definitely not. But you find that parents get anxious when their kids aren't out and about. You know, so on a Friday or Saturday
yes.
night, if your 14, 15, 16-year-old is home in his or her room, you know, just, you know, watching Netflix or writing or reading or whatever, parents think, oh, no, something's wrong because they have no friends.
Right.
They're not social. Where a lot of introverted kids I work with, they don't need to be out there a lot. On occasion, great.
Right.
But they can have a Friday or Saturday where they don't have that fear of missing out and they're perfectly happy
yeah.
in their rooms,
yeah.
just generating ideas
yeah.
and reading about things and kind of regaining some strength.
Right.
Yeah.
So for most kids, if they hear their parents or a guardian refer to them as an introvert or extrovert, it somehow in their head labels themselves, well, that must be the way that I should behave. If my parents are perceiving me that way, I got to stick to form, huh?
Yes, right. You're not going to run along with the dissonance. You're probably going to run along with what you're told. So
yeah.
if you're told early on, oh, you're extroverted, there's also this pressure like, okay, I guess I have to be really outgoing and I have to go and talk to the adults. And there's
sure.
some anxiety affiliated with that sometimes
right.
for the kids who maybe are somewhere closer to the middle of the continuum than all the way toward that extroverted end.
Do you see this very often? I know this happened with my daughters. Now, my daughters are twins, so I know the rules are slightly different for mm-hmm. twins, not dramatically, but slightly. But when they were younger, one of them was more introverted and one more extroverted, and then as time went on, they did a complete 180 flip. How and why?
Yeah, I think that happens a lot with twins. I worked with a pair of twins, girls,
yeah.
who for whom that was the same phenomenon happened, but it happens with siblings too. A lot of people go from being introverted to extroverted and back again. I don't know if you've ever had that, but I've had that in my life where there were years where I felt like I want to get out there, I want to talk to people, that's how I fuel myself.
Yeah.
And then I'll have this month or two where I kind of want to regress into myself and just kind of like sure. generate ideas. And I think the balance between the two is a really, really healthy thing. And so to think of them as discrete, that's where I think we run into trouble.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. All right. We'll take a quick break and then discuss this further. If you want to jump in, we'd love to hear from you. We're at 312-981-7200. You can call us there or text us there. It's Dr. John Duffy. You know that. All right. It's Bill Leff with you on WGN. Dr. John Duffy is my guest. Mike Toomey will be by in about 10 or 15 minutes. Stick around for that. Dr. Duffy, of course, a clinical psychologist, the best-selling author of Available Parent, and has a podcast here on WGN Plus called Better that he does with his wife, Julie. Let's talk about the age-old problem, understanding teenagers. Adults want so badly to understand our teenagers. Teenagers want so badly to understand the parents. It's not always the easiest thing in the world. What do you recommend?
No, it is quite a messy thing, in fact, I learned the other day that this is an ongoing issue. It's something I've been working with for 20-some years, but I had a father and son in my office, and the dad, in a moment of understanding, or attempted understanding, said, "Son, I know what it's like. I was 17 once," and his son very wisely said, "You were never this teenager, Dad. You were never 17 like I'm 17. There's this emotional weight. We have the internet and we have Snapchat and Instagram and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
We also have the academic pressures that you really didn't have to the same extent. And I think we can acknowledge that.
Sure.
And a whole host of other like self-esteem related issues that a lot of us don't understand. And so we purport to understand them, but we're missing the boat, and our kids are well aware of it, that we're missing the boat if we say we totally get what they're going through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what I encourage parents to do is to make teachers out of their teenagers. Ask them, you know, like, okay, so if I don't understand, tell me.
Yeah.
Help me understand. Like, how does this app work? What's going on in your grade? Are our kids vaping, juuling, having sex? Is this something we should be talking about? Is this something you're doing? And kids are way more comfortable, Bill, with this stuff than we are.
Why do you think that is? I agree with you. I just don't know why it is.
I think it's because I think we grew up with a lot of taboo around certain subjects.
Yeah.
They're exposed to so much stimuli of every kind
yeah.
from a very early age
yeah.
that I think they're kind of immune to being shocked by much of anything.
Yeah.
And so the idea of sitting down and talking to your parents about sex is not that big a deal to them. For us, it feels like, oh, God, I have no idea what to say. I don't know how to present this.
Right.
The kids are pretty casual about it.
Does it make you wonder what's coming a generation from now? Like, what will the problems be of that generation?
Right.
I mean, we've seen so many changes in the last 25 or 30 years. I can't even imagine what's coming in a generation.
In terms of, like, technology,
yeah.
I have no idea. You know, in terms of the stress the kids go through academically, given that there are more people trying to get into fewer colleges, you know, I think it amps up.
Yeah.
In terms of understanding, you know, this generation will have grown up a little more immune to the hard talks, the taboo talks.
Right.
So I have some hope that a generation from now, parents and children are going to be able to communicate more openly. I fear for young kids because, you know, they're exposed to a lot of stuff when they are developmentally not really ready for
it. Oh, yeah.
Right?
No doubt about it.
And that's going to happen more and more as time goes on. And there's nothing, I don't think, that we can really honestly do about that.
Right.
So we have to open a line of communication with them early on about the stuff we would much rather they not be exposed to and we would much rather not talk about with them.
You're talking about just simple internet access, whereas like when we were kids, it took some doing to find a Playboy magazine and look through it,
yep.
you know, and now you can Google any two words in the language and see things that no 11-year-old is ready to see.
Exactly. And yeah. I've worked with kids who no fault of their own. They're not even looking. One kid told me recently he went, he was doing research for a paper, went to whitehouse.org.
Yeah.
Which is different than whitehouse.gov. He learned the hard way.
Oh, no.
In a very wretched, horrifying way.
Wow, wow. Yeah. So I love your idea of being honest enough with your child, with your teenager, to say, I don't understand being a teenager. Because the old way was you had to try to figure out a common ground and say, look, I was a kid too once.
Yeah.
But now the better approach is to just flat out say, I'll be honest with you, I don't live in the teenage years you live in. So I don't, let's work together on this, right?
Right, right. Yeah? And talk to me about it. And you have to come into it without an agenda to some extent, Bill. Otherwise, your kids are going to be smart enough to know, well, I'm going to tell you this part, but I'm going to keep this part out of it because I want this to myself.
Right.
So you've got to say, you've got to ask your kids, well, tell me the next thing. Tell me what's going on. And some a way to take it out of their hands and kind of make it broad is to say, tell me about what's going on in your grade. What are kids up to? What are kids doing? Because I don't know. I need to learn this from you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times, John, I have said to one or both of my daughters, I know what you're going through right now to some extent, and I don't know how much you want to talk about it, but when and if you do want to talk about it, I'm available. I've tried my best to say exactly that, to say, if you never want to talk about it, I'm here to never talk about it with you. If you want to talk about it every day for the next 10 days, here I am. You know, is that the right move or the wrong move?
Everything about that, Bill, because, you know, teenagers are still teenagers.
Yeah.
Certain things they're not going to want to talk about with their parents.
Right.
But to know that you're open to it, you know, that your daughters know, like, okay, you know, if I need to, I can go to dad.
Yeah.
You know, if it gets weird late at night, I want out of here, I can call dad, no questions asked.
Yeah.
That's the safety that they need. You know, in this chaotic world, to know, like, okay, that's my constant.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, mom and dad are constants in my life, and I can rely on them unequivocally, no questions asked.
Do you also think, now, I am so a fan of equality, not just a fan of it, but a true believer in equality, but I do also think there's something to the fact that male kids might want to say something to their dad that they might not want to say to their mom, and the flip side of that, there's something to that, right?
Definitely. There's just this kind of, for some kids, they would say something along the lines of an ick factor,
yeah,
in talking about maybe something sexual with the opposite sex parent, where it's much more comfortable with the same sex parent, and that's handy that most of us have two parents, and we can go to that same sex parent. Sometimes it goes the other way around, too, oddly enough. So my bias is read your kids well enough to know where their comfort zones are.
Yes.
And don't take it personally if it's not you
right
now. Because sometimes it moves, right?
Right?
It moves from mom to dad and back again. Sometimes you're in and sometimes you're on the outs.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you maintain it's getting easier now that the walls that used to be there with certain topics have just kind of come down to some extent.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. And who do we attribute that to? Who do we say thank you for that?
That's a great question. I think in a weird way we can say thank you to ourselves.
Yeah.
I saw a couple of comedians. It was one of the Jerry Seinfeld Comedians in Cars things.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, I think we're the first generation that had a childhood. Because our parents had hard scrabble lives, and they had to survive, and they were working from a very young age. So I think now we're the first generation that gets a parenthood, where we really get to consider the self-worth and the self-esteem of our kids.
Wow.
You know?
That's brilliant.
Right. I mean, it got me thinking about this, right?
Yeah.
And so if that's true, you know, our kids, we can thank ourselves and our parents because we have the luxury now of attending to their well-being. And that's why if I give a parenting seminar, people show up.
Where
if I did it a generation ago, I'd be talking to an empty room.
Good. That's progress. That's Dr. John Duffy, clinical psychologist. Eric, thanks so much. Bill left with you on WGN. Wendy is gone for the entire week. She's in Disneyland enjoying herself, from what I understand. She'll be back on Monday. Filling in for her right now is my friend Mike Toomey from the WGN TV Morning News. Hello, Mike. Thank you so much for being here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yes. Yeah, right. Yep.
There we go. Oh, yeah.
At some point, you told me you'll be doing your Cliff Mercer impression, yes. which I enjoy immensely. Will you be doing it now or later on in the program?
The fifth WGN radio, home to million throughout Mid-America.
Cliff Mercer, of course.
Radio home to million throughout Mid-America.
A longtime announcer here for WGN television.
Yeah, and radio.
Is he still with us, do we know?
I believe not.
Oh, that's very sad.
He used to do music on a Sunday afternoon. Radio home of million throughout.
He had a slight speech impediment. A slight, and
but
yet made.
They were
too good.
Yeah.
You couldn't say no to Cliff Mercer.
Didn't matter.
Yeah. I was a big fan.
Another thwart, the Cubs lost to the Cardinals 7-6 in 16 innings. Steve Swisher had a 3-run homer at the bottom of the 7th.
Steve Swisher's name has come up on the show twice this week.
Seriously.
Because
the All-Star Game?
Yeah. He was the Cubs representative in the All-Star Game, and you have to say to yourself, boy, they must have had a magnificent team the year that Steve Swisher represented the Cubs.
They needed a catcher. It was like 76 was the year.
Yeah.
And the Cubs were not good.
Yeah.
So we have to take somebody.
Yeah.
We need a catcher. Who's their catcher? Okay.
Steve Swisher.
Bill Madlock led the league in hitting that year.
Yes, he did.
He didn't get picked, so.
Yeah. That seems right.
Yeah.
Maybe
Sparky Anderson didn't like the fact that he was battling it out with his player, Ken Griffey Sr.
Right.
No publicity for that.
All right. I want to pay you a compliment. I want to pay you a huge compliment. Here's what it is. I've been reading a book called Robin that was written by a man named Dave Itzkoff. We had Dave on the air with us about a month and a half ago. He wrote a book about Robin Williams. I don't know if you've read the book or not. It's fantastic. It's just great. So we get to know things that we already knew about Robin Williams, and there's a bunch of new stuff that I didn't know about Robin Williams. Despite the fact that I'm in the middle of this book, HBO is now running a documentary also about Robin Williams.
I've heard that, yep.
I watched about 45 minutes of it the other night, and it's also great. It's all of his closest friends. It's everyone from Billy Crystal to Bob Goldthwait, who was the best man at, I think, 2 out of his 3 weddings.
Okay.
Who did the other one?
So you know what? I'm going to give somebody else a shot.
Cliff Mercer.
What?
He was the best man.
Where did I put the ring? Wait a minute. It's in my other suit. Can I?
But here's why I bring it up. Robin Williams, who I think anyone who ever saw him would admit is, if not a genius, really, really close to a genius, had some trouble throughout his life.
Yeah.
And if you saw Gary Shandling's documentary about Gary Shandling's life, you learned that Gary Shandling, as great as he was, had some trouble in his life. And you have been doing stand-up comedy for over 30 years and have worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of comics. And I'm sure you've recognized a lot of those guys got into stand-up comedy because something wasn't quite right in their life.
Right.
So I bring this up because I've known you forever. And that's not your story at all.
No, and that's what's holding me back.
Is it really?
Got to point to something.
You need something to make things dark.
More dysfunction.
Right. But would you agree with me that most of the guys that you have seen, either working with or you got to know from TV or whatever, they got into this line of work to fill some deficiency that was there?
Yeah, we've seen some tortured souls.
Awful.
Yeah.
So why are you so different from all those stand-up comics, do you think?
I kind of look at it like this way. If you put a bunch of comedians in a room, you're going to have all different kinds of guys or girls from different backgrounds.
Yeah.
It's like you put 10 car salesmen or 10 bankers in a room. They're all going to be different.
Yeah.
You can't just say every person that works here in this profession has this personality. You know
but there
mean?
Were always you saw patterns.
Certainly, yeah.
There were guys that got into it because they thought, oh, this would be great. There will be girls everywhere.
Well, in the 80s, when comedy was everywhere, there were guys who weren't necessarily comedians. They were more technicians.
Yeah.
Like, I know how to run the board here. I know write the joke, punchline here, you know, and raise my inflection here, talk louder here, you know.
Yeah.
End this sentence with a scream and everybody will clap.
Right.
There was a lot of that.
Yeah. It was just, it was almost like a Mad Libs. Remember that?
Right.
Like where you just had to fill in an adjective, put in a noun. They were doing stand-up, but it was by the book.
Yep.
Right?
All you had to do was put up a sign. Back then, all you had to do was put up a sign and say, we have comedy, and people would come.
Yeah.
I worked a club. You probably did this club. It was in Milwaukee, the Comedy Cafe.
Sure.
1 week I was there, and the sign, you know, the marquee, it just said, 3 guys.
Those were the worst.
It sold out.
Time.
I was one of those guys.
3 guys.
And I take all the credit for the shows that sold out.
All right. So when I started, because, all right, here's what happened. And I think you already know this. I did stand up 1 week, and I worked with two guys that were just miserable. They were very happy gentlemen on stage, and then off stage they were miserable. Mm-hmm. Then I did stand-up comedy a second week, and those guys were even more miserable.
Right.
And then I said to my wife, the girlfriend at the time, but then my wife, I said, I'm going to give this one more week, and I don't want to become those guys. I don't want to be a guy who pretends to be happy on stage for an hour a night and then is miserable. And I worked with you, and you saved me, because I said, wow, Mike is the same guy on stage and off stage, so that's realistic. You can do that. Because I swear, if I hadn't just by chance worked with you on that show, I wouldn't be doing anything like this now. You saved me.
Well,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Not really. But
no, you did. You really did. Because so many of those guys... you know, because this isn't New York and Los Angeles and the stakes weren't quite as high, they were just kind of floating through this, just trying to find a direction. But you kind of knew, right? You had it all figured out.
Yeah. When I was, you know, you left out that part of when I pulled you out of the burning building in Lansing, Michigan. Remember that?
Thank you for doing that. Thank you for doing that.
The beams were falling.
They were about to fall. Yeah. It was a marshmallow roast gone horribly wrong.
We were pretty banged up.
Yeah. Who do you see throughout your career? Because you've been doing this so well for so long, Mike, but who have you seen and just said, wow, that guy or that girl, they are so good. I could never do what they do. Is there somebody like that?
You mean over the years or currently?
Yeah, over the years.
Well, I mean, we know who we grew up listening to. Carlin was always like the go-to. My brother had the class clown that had the seven words. So I would, you know, with the big giant headphones, I would hide and listen to that, because if my parents heard me listen to the swear words,
that'd be trouble.
I'd be in big trouble.
Yeah.
Here's my litmus test. I think if you can transcribe someone's act and read it and it's funny, that to me is a really good comic.
Isn't that interesting? Because that certainly holds true for George Carlin, but Robin Williams, who I mentioned a minute ago,
maybe not.
It would not work.
No, but that's not to say he doesn't have a lot of talent.
I mean,
he's extremely gifted.
Right,
was rather, but and great. But as a stand, I mean, you know, like Jim Gaffigan, you could read Jim Gaffigan's act,
and it's hysterical to read.
And you would laugh.
Yeah. Brian Regan is the same.
Definitely.
There's a bunch.
Yeah,
there's a bunch. But even Robin Williams' closest friend said, If somebody else said this stuff, you would just stare at him.
Right.
You wouldn't understand why anyone's laughing. But he had a likability factor that was just so strong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Frank Caliendo, we both know.
Yeah.
Great impressionist, and he said he's followed that Robin Williams school of, you know, just keep it going.
Yeah.
Don't shut it down. Change the voice. Change it. You know, it's frenetic. It's funny.
You know,
it comes off funny in a different way.
Is George Carlin the best that's ever done this?
In my opinion, yes.
I think so too.
I think so.
Yeah. Because why?
Because it was about the material and the mastery of the language.
Yeah.
Like, he did not waste a single word.
Right.
You know, everything he said was counted for something.
Right.
His inflection. And he said he would listen to it and try and say it different ways to himself when he was working on it.
Yeah. You know what I thought was one of the most interesting things about him? I saw him perform on television so many times, or heard the record so many times. After he died, we hear about his daughter. And I thought to myself, for most stand-up comics, if they had a daughter, if they were a father, that would certainly come into play during his stand-up. But I don't remember him ever doing a thing where he goes, you know, I'm a dad, and talk about that.
No, he never did.
He just left it alone.
No, he just...
What was behind that, do you think?
You know, I didn't even realize it until you just said it right now.
Yeah.
He was just every man's comic. You know?
Yeah.
And towards the end, it was more about, these things bother me.
You know
what I mean? And this is where I'm coming from here. And he always had a different way to look at stuff.
He became very curmudgeonly as he got older. Like, there was an element to that when he was young, but when he was old, it was it permeated almost everything he did.
Well, when he was young, he had to fit into the box, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at old video of him, he wore a suit.
Right.
He was clean shaven.
He
had short hair.
Yeah.
And then the more he got to bust out and be himself, then he had the long hair and he was talking more about what he wanted to talk about instead of conforming.
And there's a parallel with him doing that and Richard Pryor doing that, because early Richard Pryor is the same, a very clean-cut, well-dressed, polite version, and then at some point both of them realized,
I'm going to say what I want to say.
Yeah. And that made all the difference.
It's that, like, everywhere. Look at old, like, in music. Look at Frank Zappa when he was 22 years old. He looked just like that, too. They all looked the same with their short hair and the skinny tie and the suit.
Right. But then you could also bring that to the Beatles, too, and say, because I remember as a kid, when I was learning about the magic of the Beatles, going, wait, those same four guys that I see wearing the suits and just moving their head back and forth, and then the hippie boys,
right.
those are the that's the same guys?
Yeah.
So there's just, at some point, there's an emergence
yep.
for those guys. All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break. Mike Toomey's here. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200, we'd be thrilled to hear from you. It's Bill Left with you on WGN. My guest is Mike Toomey, my friend Mike Toomey, who works over on the WGN TV Morning News. Mike, the other day you guys did a block party. How was that? I saw a little bit of it on TV.
That was so much fun.
Was that in Homewood?
In Homewood, yeah. And I didn't realize it. Apparently, Homewood, they have like those kid jumpers and like food stands in the streets in Homewood.
They do?
Yeah.
In the streets?
Yes.
That's dangerous.
Like everywhere you go, there's like food stands and those things for kids to jump on.
I love that idea.
God, what a fun place to live.
It's like that year-round in Homewood?
Every day I go there, it is.
When I was growing up in Oak Forest, Homewood was never referred to as Homewood. It was Homewood-Flossmoor. It did not have its own identity. If you were going to talk about Homewood, you better talk about Flossmoor.
Flossmoor has since seceded from that.
From the union of Homewood? Why?
Did they I don't know. I don't know what went on between
the two. A brouhaha?
Something went on between the two of them. It wasn't pretty. I'm hoping one day they patch it up.
I mentioned the other day, it was always Homewood-Flossmoor, and then the same thing happened with the good people of Crete and Moni. You couldn't get any separation.
That was a bad one, that breakup.
That was like a civil war.
That was terrible.
Yeah. Yep.
We lost a few that day.
Very sad, but true. I don't like to look at me. I'm getting all misty just thinking about it. I'm getting crazy. You were with us filling in for Wendy a couple weeks ago, and you brought something up that I enjoyed immensely.
Yes.
You said that as a man, it's very hard for you to hear or say certain words.
Yes.
And do you remember the one you used as an example?
Yeah, and I have a hard time saying it myself.
Do you want me to say it? Would you feel better?
I'm not going to like when you say it, but yes.
Do you want to leave the room for a minute while
I
say it?
It's all right.
You said that you're not comfortable being around the word yummy.
I hate when people say it.
Men or women?
Either, yeah.
Yeah?
And when they type it, too, I don't like when somebody, hey, we're having this to eat, and then they type that back.
It'll be yummy.
Yeah, that's gross.
What about if someone were to shorten it and just eat, let's say you brought me a maraschino cherry. You go, Bill, try this.
Yeah.
And I put it in my mouth, and I enjoyed it, and I went, yum.
That's bad.
That would also be bad.
It's roughly a form of the word. That's what Alan Ludden told me.
So
can't like one and hate the other.
So any variation on the theme that is yummy, you're not a part of.
Right.
You will avoid. Do you remember Jewel Food Stores for a while? Their in-house brand was yummy.
Yep, and it was a smiley face logo.
I think it was a boy and a girl. It was a little boy and a little girl, both with huge smiles on their faces because they just enjoyed some yummy orange soda.
And it was good stuff, too.
But you wouldn't play that by those rules.
Right.
Well, I have a surprise for you.
Okay.
We're not going to do this now. We're going to do this on the bonus hour on the stream of consciousness.
Okay.
I found a bunch of words that when you say them, they will instantly reveal your age.
Oh.
Like there's a separation between the words that you're comfortable saying and the words your children are comfortable saying. Just by age.
Okay. So if you use these words on a regular basis, it gives people an idea how old you are.
Can I give you a quick example?
Contraption? Is that on there?
I don't see contraption, but I understand
that. Let me see that contraption you're playing with over there.
So that would be an older person's way. Like if a kid had like a fidget spinner.
Sure.
You wouldn't know what that is, so you would call it a contraption.
It's a contraption.
Yeah. This is just one to whet everybody's appetite so that they follow us to the stream.
Okay.
My parents used to say this, I can't speak for yours, but if you were dating somebody, you wouldn't say that you were dating, you would say that you're going with them.
Yeah, you're still going with that girl?
Right.
Right. We're going.
That always bothered me as a kid because I wanted to know where we should be going.
Right. Who's he going with these days? I like it.
Here's another one. If, let's say I'm in agreement with you.
Uh-huh.
I would say ditto, but a kid today would never in a million years say ditto.
Did you ever say that, though?
I didn't say it, but I would hear people from time to time throw that out.
Right. After Ghost, a lot of people said. Remember Ghost, the movie Ghost with Whoopi Goldberg?
Oh, right. Yeah. But I don't remember why.
They would always say that to each other, Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore.
Oh, their characters would use ditto.
He would never tell her he loved her. He would just say ditto.
Ditto.
Yeah.
But it, of course, came way before then, but because of the movie, it became kind of popular to say that.
Yeah, kind of had a resurgence.
Yeah.
Because of that movie.
Yeah. I don't know. Now that you say it, I don't remember ever saying it myself, but from time to time, you'd hear somebody say it.
I'd hear someone repeat it.
Yeah.
which is weird.
So on the it is weird. Yeah. So somebody would say ditto, and then they would go
ditto to that.
Yeah. That's so. Well, I never. That's a very viable option. So when Mike and I go to the stream of consciousness, the bonus hour, we will read you a bunch of these words that maybe because of the generations, they've just kind of faded away. But if you say them, a kid will look at you and go, what are you, a dinosaur? Why would you say those words?
You know what? Ditto, like a lot of people would, instead of ditto, they would say, I echo those sentiments.
People said that?
Which is longer, yeah.
That would take all day.
Yeah.
All right, that's coming up on the stream. Stick around. We'll meet with Steve. We'll find out what he's got on the Wintrust Business Lunch. That's coming up in just a little bit. It's Bill and Mike on WGN. Mike, somebody has texted us their favorite generational word. This is a word that you and I wouldn't say because we live in the present, but maybe our parents would say this, and that is instead of throwing up, you would upchuck.
I remember that one.
Remember that? Okay. That was popular.
Certainly.
Yeah. Nobody does it anymore.
No.
It's a thing of the past.